Greetings everyone and welcome to the Vookcast, Australia's Nintendo podcast. My name's Angelo Valdivia and with me this week are Oliver Brand.
G'day folks.
Luke Henderson.
Howdy howdy.
And Michael Goncalves.
Hey team.
We've got a great episode lined up for you this week, all about a big discussion around our favourite video game documentaries and analyses YouTube channels, plus the upcoming Fortnite forecast, some big releases heading our way, but let's start off with a quick look at Nintendo's second quarter financial report. So I might actually hand this one over to Ollie, since he's the financials man over here, so he can take us through a little bit of a surprise to me, at least, that this hadn't already happened.
Yeah, so I was actually here for the financials this time, so I was very excited because I missed out on the last one. But Mario Kart 8 Deluxe has now outsold Mario Kart Wii, which makes it the best-selling game in the Mario Kart series. Which, yeah, is surprising it hasn't happened already. But, I mean, pretty good effort for an enhanced port of a game that came out on Wii U. It's crazy that, like, they haven't added more content to it, or made another Mario Kart. Like, I feel like no matter what they do with Mario Kart, it's going to sell really, really well. So it's a little bit weird. But, yeah, it has over 38 million units on Switch, which is about a million more than Mario Kart Wii. And that's not counting any of the Wii U sales for Mario Kart 8 either, which I think was like a good 6 or 7 million on that as well. So it's really, really impressive.
Yeah, so I made a note there saying that like the shelf life of the two games. So Mario Kart Wii came out 18 months after the Wii's launch in 2006. So it came out like what, April or something like that, or May of 2008. And Mario Kart 8 Deluxe came out 6 weeks after the Switch's launch in 2017. So what's that? So in about 2008 to late 2012, that's like about 4.5 years thereabouts, we'd say, for the lifetime of Mario Kart Wii, getting like 37 million sales. And then Mario Kart 8 Deluxe, what, 4.5 years as well, thereabouts, similar. Yeah, so that's interesting.
And like, throwing the maths, there's like almost 42% of all Switch owners own Mario Kart, which is just insane.
Yeah, that's an attach rate that like any other console manufacturer would just be absolutely pleased to have. That it just doesn't happen.
But then I also wonder, like, because I don't know if this, I guess this probably skews the sales of Switch consoles as well. Like, some people have doubled up, they have like a second console in the house, or a Switch Lite or an OLED or something like that. So I don't know how that sort of works out. Like, there's two Switches in our household, for example, but only one copy of Mario Kart 8.
Yeah, so it is actually based on actual like paid copies shipped and bought on the eShop, so it is individual copies sold rather than accounts that have played it. But other interesting details, Animal Crossing has slowed right down. Not really surprising, but it did about a million in the last quarter, which, you know, is still pretty respectable, but you know, compared to some other games, it's slowed right down. We're expecting that'll see a bit of a boost now that the DLC and the big update are out, just because it'll be all over social media, and that usually means that there's going to be a boost in sales. We also expect that the Switch, by the end of this financial year, so to the end of March, we suspect that the Switch will have sold more units than the Wii, which is just utterly insane. But yeah, we expect that, you know, in 6 months' time, the Switch will be the best-selling home console from Nintendo, and well on its track, depending on how long Nintendo want to keep it around, to become the best-selling console of all time. It's still got quite a way to go, but I think it could absolutely get there, given the current sales trajectory. The other thing that we learned a couple days after the financials dropped themselves is that there are 32 million Nintendo Switch Online subscribers. So that counts individual people in a family group. So like if there's a full group of eight, that counts as eight. So it's not 32 million subscriptions, but 32 million people with access to Nintendo Switch Online, which gives it about a 35% attach rate for Nintendo Switch Online compared to Switches sold. Which is fairly in line with other consoles. The PS4, for example, has about a 40 to 42% attach rate for PS Plus. There aren't figures for Xbox Live, but I imagine it'd be pretty similar over there as well. So it's doing well, and it, like, basically, as somebody said in our Discord, with having a 30% attach rate, a 35% attach rate, that means that, like, they are incentivized to actually improve the Nintendo Switch Online Plus expansion pack, because onboarding those people onto the more expensive plan would be good for them, because they already have those 35 million people subscribed. Whether or not they will, I mean, it's Nintendo. As I've always said, like, expect the worst and be surprised if something better happens. Slow quarter overall. Quarter two is usually very quiet because it's June to September, and really what happens in June to September in terms of video games.
The only two games Nintendo shipped in that quarter were Skyward Sword HD and WarioWare. Skyward Sword HD did 3.6 million copies, and WarioWare didn't even rate a mention in the sales numbers.
So it sold under a million copies. But it was only on sale for like 10 days in the reporting period. So we can't really expect to see too many numbers, but I don't think we'll ever really get full numbers for that, because I don't think it's going to sell over a million in any given quarter.
Interesting, though, we did find out afterwards that Luigi's Mansion 3 sold another 700,000 or so it's bumped it up to over 10 million.
Yep.
So it's done really well for Nintendo.
I think somebody was saying on Twitter earlier that that Skyward Sword HD has actually outsold the original Skyward Sword. Games are doing well on Switch, as they always have been and probably always will do. Very slow quarter. It'll be interesting to see the next couple quarters, particularly the holiday period, because that's where Nintendo just usually goes absolute gangbusters. And with two Pokemon games in the next two quarters, I can't imagine them not reaching or very much surpassing their goals.
I wonder what will sell more this holiday season, the GTA trilogy or Pokemon?
I mean, it's Pokemon.
On Switch or in general?
On Switch. Like, I genuinely wonder. Like, I know Pokemon would be popular, but, like, there are a lot more older people on Switch these days who are using the Switch as their main console, who played GTA back in the day.
Yeah, I think GTA is going to be hampered by the fact that it doesn't have a widespread physical release.
That's true.
It will have a physical version, but
that's in, like,
it's not going to be... Yeah.
December 7.
It's not going to be, on store shelves in every single store. Like, we can pretty much guarantee that, like, Target and Kmart, I don't think Kmart even sells games, but, like, Target and like, mainstay places like that probably aren't going to have it on the shelves, because they got burned by GTA 5 after so many people complained about it for dumb reasons. I think because Pokemon is so well known, and is going to be, like, hundreds and hundreds of copies on every single store shelf, I think it just by sheer presence alone, it's probably gonna eke it out and probably do very well. But we'll see.
I think GTA is also going to be hampered by the fact that it's a digital-only release, so people will see it, people playing GTA later this week, and they'll want it, so they might just go digital because it's there. Whereas when it does hit retail, it'd be like, well, I already had it digitally. I don't need it again here.
Yeah.
So I think that split release cadence is gonna hurt them. Something that I find interesting, I like to do this for all the big games, is that Mario Kart 8 Deluxe on Switch, since the day it came out to the end of September, has sold on average 17 copies a minute.
Yeah.
Just to show how massive that sale rate is.
So, yeah, we're about one every 3 seconds or so, which... it's pretty cool if you're Nintendo and you're making millions and millions of dollars off a single game. For everybody else, I mean, it's good to know that lots of people have the game if you want to play multiplayer.
Alrighty. Let's move on to our featured discussion. So talking about video game documentaries and analyses YouTube channel. So I just want to put some ground rules out there. So we're not talking about, like, general YouTube channels where we do things like, opinion pieces or... or review channels and things like that. I think those are kind of, you know, whatever, you know, those are a dime a dozen. When we talk about analysis channels or analyses channel, we're talking about things, you know, that kind of dive into like the story of, what am I trying to say here? Taking a fundamental like function within a game and really explaining how it works and things like that. Things that really break apart what the game actually is and explain things rather than just provide an opinion and a thumbs up or screaming at the camera or something like that. But who would like to go first?
As I said prior to the show recording, I'll go first because I don't actively watch most of these things because I don't have a lot of time for them. And when I do actually have time to do things, I'm generally watching something that's not video game related because just to get my mind off video games. But I will say, though, I have seen the occasional NoClip documentary around specific series when they do. I don't watch all their stuff, but when they deep dive into like the Hades, the saga of how they made Hades, that one I watched. And I did watch the E3 special they did a few years back because it's always interesting to see the experience of other people when they're at E3 compared to what I'm doing as well. So, yeah, that's all I generally do watch when I have time, but it's very rare that I have time for those. So that's me.
Cool. I'll jump in next because I have the shortest list of anyone here. So the two big ones that I want to mention are Summoning Salt and New Frame Plus. Summoning Salt is one of my favorite channels on YouTube and one of my favorite forms of entertainment in general. It is a channel that does deep dive documentaries into the history of speedrunning records, which is just massively interesting. Every single one that he picks is super, super well researched, super well presented. The way that the person who runs that channel weaves a story through the thing, you know, there's upsets and drama and you know, people overthrowing, and then there's like names that pop up.
So in much every drama. So much drama.
But you know, there's names that pop up in because you know there are some pretty high profile speedrunners, especially in the early days, that speedrun basically everything. And if you've been a viewer of the channel for a long time, you'll start like taking note of those games, and it's like, wow, like how did this person go from like Ocarina of Time to, you know, Mario Kart 64 to, you know, then eventually holding the record for Super Mario Brothers on the NES for like 3 years. So it's really, really interesting, and you get to learn a little bit about the history of speedrunning for those particular games, but then how speedrunning's evolved in general, because, you know, a lot of them, they start, you know, in the early days where people were like taping things on VHSs and then sending them into websites to be verified. And there's a few of them as well that like showed, you know, this person has cheated, and they goes over like how they figured out that person cheated and how they got those records illegitimately. So it's a really, really fantastic channel for speedrunning history. And if you're really interested in speedrunning at all, the production value on that is just through the roof. And it's a fantastic watch. As I said, the other one is New Frame Plus, which is run by Dan, who used to be on Extra Credits, who used to be the host of Extra Credits. He is an animator who's worked in video games in the past, and he does full breakdowns of animations in video games. So one of the recent ones that he did was a feature-length documentary about the animation in the Sonic series. So he went the Sonic series. So he went through every single 3D Sonic game, played them all from start to finish, and analyzed the animation in every single one of them, which is just an absolutely monumental effort. It took him like over a year to play and edit and script the video. And just, you know, at least once a month he puts out a video breaking down the animation of a particular game, or, you know, one of the things that I think sort of shot him to popularity a couple years ago was that, like, he did an analysis of animations in Pokemon. And basically this was before Sword and Shield happened, and we knew that like some Pokemon had to be cut out. And one of the things that he said in that is that like the amount of effort that they go into making these animations for Pokemon just exponentially grows with every single Pokemon that they add. So, you know, there's 1,100 unique forms for Pokemon, and for every 5 animations that you need to make for a new feature, that's 5,500 animations that you need to do. So he was basically saying like during that time that eventually they're going to have to start cutting Pokemon because it's just not economical to be able to do 5,000 10,000, 15,000 animations every single time you add a new feature.
So it's the Kirby problem from Smash. Every time they put a new fighter in Smash, they need to animate Kirby to match that fighter.
Yeah. So, yeah, really, really fantastic channel. And probably one of the more informative channels about video games on YouTube, because there's a lot of stuff that you don't really think about, particularly when it comes to animations and how animations, even small animations, can change the way a game looks and feels to play. And it's not something that you really think about until you like sit down and watch one of these videos where it's like, wow, that tiny animation of like, you know, you walked up to a wall and your character like put their hand on it to lean against it as they were going through like a tunnel or whatever. You don't realize how much that adds to the game until you see it without that. So yeah, New Frame Plus, absolutely fantastic. The other ones I want to mention for analyses channels, Digital Foundry is just so good at breaking down the tech that goes into games. Obviously, they're known for the stuff that they do with Eurogamer. For they do a lot of pixel peeping. They tell us, you know, it's running at this frame rate and, you know, this many pixels in the frame. But they also do just like absolute deep dives into how they pulled, like how developers have pulled off particular techniques and they've been doing a lot of retro stuff lately, just like looking at how some of the techniques that they used in those older consoles happened. And that's really, really interesting because the people behind Digital Foundry are so technologically proficient, and they understand all of the stuff that they're doing, that I don't think there's really anyone better in the world right now that can analyze these kinds of things.
With them, it's not that just they understand it, it's that they can translate it into a way that other people can understand it.
Yeah.
They're not just throwing tech jargon at you and making you hope for the best.
Oh, I don't know. There are sometimes I've watched their episodes and I'm like, I have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, you mean like they're talking about like subsurface scattering and
I love it. This is my jam.
But yeah, so they're good. Game Maker's Toolkit, probably a little bit more aimed towards game developers. But I think it's really
good. This is legitimately one of my favorite channels.
I think it's really fantastic as well, yeah.
Because they really do, they're not like as long as some of the other videos, like there's no, you know, 2 hour long videos on Game Maker's Toolkit, but they do go into like, you know, how to do good game design and what makes all of these facets of games that, you know, we just interact with, you know, what goes into making those and what goes into making those good, and where games go wrong, because I think it's really important to look at that. It's important for me as, you know, a video game critic to watch stuff like this, because I think it really helps inform sort of like growing that sort of knowledge base, helps you form better opinions about the games that you're playing, because there's a lot of stuff that you just would overlook unless you knew what you were looking for. Yeah, that's fantastic. Alex McCullough is a wonderful, wonderful musician who's recently been doing deep dives into compositions in video games. He's been doing a lot of Genshin Impact stuff recently, which is great because the Genshin Impact composer is just one of the best in the game. But he does a lot of breaking down the music in video games, reacting to them, and, you know, even transforming them. He does a lot of, like, you know, this song but funky, which is very exciting to see. Yeah, and then just, like, for random stuff, there's LGR, Lazy Game Reviews, which, you know, looks at retro tech and games in particular, particularly more on the PC gaming side of things. And same with the 8-bit guy, also more on the, like, early PC side of things. It's a little less documentary and a little more just kind of fun. Like, look at all this like cool retro stuff. But it, like, both of them do have sort of like documentary style formats that they employ from time to time about, you know, the history of the Commodore or you know, the history of DOS gaming in general, which I've enjoyed a lot of, even though I wasn't really playing PC games back then. I've really enjoyed watching that. And the other one's a little bit of a weird pick. It's Highlight Reel. So this is something that used to happen over on Kotaku, but then it's spun out to its own thing. And it's not documentary. It's just every Thursday there's a bunch of clips from around the internet showing cool things that happen in games, glitches, etc. And like, while it might not be sort of documentarian, it is, I think, a really fascinating record of what was popular at what time and, you know, the way that games evolve over time, which I think, you know, in 20 years' time, you know, people will be looking at things like Highlight Reel to see, you know, how the popularity of particular games rose and fall over time, because that's not something that, like, you can really see. Like, well, like, we don't know really how particular Call of Duty games, for example, became popular and unpopular, because there just wasn't really a record of that in popular culture. So I think in time, Highlight Reel is going to be one of those really useful resources. But now it's just, you know, every week it's a fun video to watch. And that's my picks.
Cool. All right. Michael, would you like to go next?
Sure. My list is reasonably long, so I'm going to do some selections from it. but my first one is a channel called Ahoy. Ahoy is a really awesome channel that does a whole lot of sometimes mini documentaries, sometimes longer length documentaries on a whole lot of stuff in gaming that just have an insanely high production value. They've always got incredible music, incredible graphics to go with them. He does an amazing series called Iconic Arms, which literally goes through specific weapons in games. So there's stuff about the rocket launcher, the stuff around the P90 in video games, the M60, all that type of stuff, and how they changed between games from the early days and up till now. And he also does a ton of longer length, I guess, feature documentaries. One of my favorites on his channel by far is the documentary on Polybius, which is a video game that doesn't exist but was always rumored to exist. It had a really weird backstory around it where it was said to be used by the CIA to do mind control experiments on et cetera, on people. It's a really great doco. I 100% recommend people check it out. There's also an amazing one.
That one sounds a lot like, you know, my cousin has an uncle who works at Nintendo style, level rumor. Everyone just believes it.
But even way worse than that, because it goes it's so deep rooted in pop culture and finding a weird news article from it back in that. It's really, really cool. I recommend you watch it. It's awesome. He also does a deep dive into one of my favorite games of all time, The Secret of Monkey Island. Has some great ones on what is the first video game ever made and going back in time and seeing the different suggestions that people have had, this is the first video game, and it's oh, actually, was it? Let's go back in time further. It's very, very, very cool. My next pick, which is super awesome, is one called RMC The Cave. This is run by a gentleman named Neil. He actually just finished a project creating a physical space, which is called The Cave, where it's just a complete showcase of classic consoles and old computers that he'll be opening up for the public to visit, basically. It's in the UK. It's really, really awesome. He's done a video series on constructing that physical space, which, like I said, just 2 days ago finished up. But it also has a whole load of individual videos on retro games consoles and retro computing. A lot of it is to do with hey, let's look into the history of this, let's talk about how this came about, let's talk to the people who designed it, and let's also go into restoring these things as well, because a lot of the times these things are just horrendously broken or just, you know, they just don't work properly. Which is cool. He is the author of one of the books that I recommended the other day, the Retro Tea Breaks. He interviews a whole lot of classic computer video game designers and whatnot. So if you're into that retro console, retro PC side of things, highly recommended. My next pick is a channel called Story Mode. Story mode is from a creator called Michael. He also does another channel called Lessons from the Screenplay, which is a great one about film.
One of my absolute faves.
Totally awesome. Very, very wicked channel. So he's done a spin-off about for the art of video games, basically. And there's a ton of amazing short-form little documentaries, some of them a little bit longer, on stuff like, you know, how, you know, like the dinosaurs were meaningless without alloy in that game. And there's a new series that he just started just one day ago where they play through a particular part of a game with the developers that are there, and they talk through exactly what's going on with that. It only started roughly a year ago, so in comparison to all the other channels that I've mentioned, it's reasonably new. But if you're into that type of content about learning around how games work and the storytelling behind games, there's a great one about the companion cube and the psychology behind creating the companion cube, which is really, really cool. I definitely recommend checking that out. And also checking out his other channel, Lessons from the Screenplay About Film, which is just incredible. Another one of my faves, he's only done a couple of videos on games, but it's Good Blood. And I think I recommend this particular video around Ocarina of Time to pretty much everyone that I know that is into video games. It's about half an hour long, and it goes into the subtext of Ocarina of Time and how sorrow and the concept of sorrow is woven into all aspects of the game. And it's just so incredibly researched and written, and again, very, very highly produced. I recommend people check it out. It's just awesome. Getting into a little bit more technical side of things, there's a channel called Retro Game Mechanics Explained, who does some short forms, some a little bit longer videos on how video games work and how the developers and designers of these games did the things that they did. So the stuff around how do the colors work on the NES and how they made sprites, talking around how they did the vector graphics on the Vectrex and the Atari and stuff like that, talking about how the different layers worked in old NES games, so how the actual visuals are built up. There's an incredible series on there on the Super Nintendo, which really, really deep dives into exactly how all the mechanics of making a SNES game work, like how the graphics and palettes work, how objects work, how the color math works. I think the SNES is probably one of the most understood video game consoles at this point, of how that stuff works in the background. And the whole series pretty much pegged exactly around that. And my last pick, I would say I would do a channel called Joseph Anderson, which does a whole load of video game analysis videos. And these videos vary in length quite a bit. We're talking about this a little bit before the podcast starts. There's a video on here that he released that is a review of Forager, which is 11 minutes. And then the last video that he put up is a Witcher 2 commentary video, which is 5 hours and 5 minutes long. So there's a whole load of different content on here, from critiques to reviews on video games. And it goes, as you can tell, can go quite in depth on the critiques of these games. So I highly recommend them.
Cool. And just as a heads up for anyone, like Michael didn't go through his whole list there, but I'll be putting all of these in the show's notes. So if you're going to follow on any of these that we're talking about, because there's quite a lot, just head to the show notes in your podcast app and just, you know, follow the links. For my picks, I went more with documentary style things. So it kind of goes in chronological order. So first off is a TV series by G4, an American television channel that was on Foxtel back in the early 2000s that I actually got to catch until it got merged with, sorry, it was Tech TV in Australia and America as well, and then it merged with G4, and then the series didn't survive much longer. It wasn't even broadcast in Australia on Foxtel anymore after that. But the first show was called Icons, and Icons is a documentary series which actually is a true to form documentary series where they actually do interviews with people at the time. So it goes through, like, for example, there's a whole episode about the Dreamcast that I vividly remember seeing a few times, where they actually interviewed a whole bunch of people who were working at Sega at the time and journalists who were working in the games industry at the time. And these are, like, you know, journalists who would work for major newspapers who were covering video games, not video game journalists, like the modern era of video game journalists that we'll be used to now. And it's just really, really interesting stories about the development of games or the development of consoles and all these other kinds of things. And it ran from 2002 to 2007. And the whole series is up on YouTube. There's actually a YouTube channel that someone has just been collating the episodes and putting them all up there for posterity, which is great. Next one is The King of Kong, A Fistful of Dollars. This one was really popular at the time when it came out. Yeah, Michael's throwing up the fist. Which is a documentary following Steve Wiebe, who was a newcomer to the record scene, the high school scene of arcade video games in the mid-2000s, where he jumped in and tried to break the world record for Donkey Kong at the time, where he had to beat Billy Mitchell. So that story's sort of kind of famous. And Billy Mitchell's been in all sorts of controversies, you know, since then, as pretty much just the internet's just big jerk of video games. But the documentary itself follows that story. And it was one of the first, I think it's pretty much one of the first documentary films about video games. And it's just done in a really, really interesting way. That's streaming on Amazon Prime, but you may need a VPN to access it in Australia. Then there's also Indie Game the Movie, which was a film that was distributed on Steam, I believe, at the time. And I think it was kickstarted. And it follows the journey of Phil Fish when he was developing, what's the name of that game that he did? That 3D pixel game?
Fez,
that's it. Yep, following his journey when he was developing that, as well as Team Meat when they were doing Super Meat Boy, and Jonathan Blow when he, just around the time that he had published, I'm forgetting all these indie games. What was his indie game? The side-scrolling one?
Braid,
that's it. So it's the story of those games and you know, from their development through to publishing and how the various successes came about on their games. So that was a really interesting one that had much more of a character-specific angle, where it really sort of followed their journey into making the games. Free-to-Play is one that came out in 2014. This one was also distributed on Steam because I'm pretty sure it was co-funded by Valve, which... is a documentary about the first ever international contest for Dota 2. So the contest, the international, where it was about the first winners of the event itself and following their journey through that. And really, for me especially, it brought to light esports. You know, years after the fact that esports had really been a thing, and online esports had really become bigger outside of just first-person shooters like Halo and Counter-Strike, and now we were starting to get to more strategy and MOBAs and things like that. So that's another good one. I'm pretty sure that one's still on Steam to watch for free. Then there was Double Fine Adventure, which I've only actually just started recently. This was funded on Kickstarter by Tim Schafer and his team at Double Fine, following the adventure of their Kickstarted game, Broken Age. And then I think it kind of went on for a few years after that, following their development on other games. And I think it only finished like 2 or 3 years ago or something. And it's a long-running series, just like, you know, just looking into the development process and different aspects of that. Raising Kratos was a really popular one that came out a couple of years ago, following the development of God of War on PS4. A lot of people probably seen that one, so there's not a whole lot to say about that. High Score was a Netflix published documentary series that came out last year that was kind of popular. It wasn't as popular as things like Tiger King at the time, but probably for a lot of gamers, you know, they took a lot of interest in it when it came out late last year. Super cool series. It's about 6 episodes or something like that. Each one's about 40 or 50 minutes long. And it goes through some bigger points of the history of video games. So it focuses on a specific aspect of the gaming industry, like, you know, first person shooters with Doom and things like that. And that's a really, really interesting series to follow along with. As mentioned before, there's no clip. Lots and lots of stuff there. I've only really watched the first couple of years of their content. I haven't paid a whole lot of attention to their more recent stuff. But you know, their Rocket League documentary is still fantastic, IMO, and their Fallout one as well, when they did Fallout 4. That was a really good one too. There's Gaming Historian. If you're ever if you've been reading any video game history books or anything like that, and you want to know more about a specific aspect of video game history, like, you know, the development of something or whatever, or like, you know, a piece of game hardware or something like that, chances are the Gaming Historian has actually touched upon it in like an extended episode that goes for maybe about an hour or something like that. Really good series, very long running series. It's been going for almost 10 years at this point. Some of his older stuff looks a bit janky because, you know, early days of YouTube, but over the times he's really developed a really good style and gotten more coherent as it's, not that it wasn't coherent to begin with, but a lot more coherent, cohesive as it's gone on. And then just a couple of more little throwaway things. 8-bit music theory for those who just want to look into video game compositions and how they're made and how older games still follow traditional rules of harmonization or jazz theory or chord progressions and things like that. And Feminist Frequency, which, you know, a lot of people have a lot of opinions about that show. It kicked a lot of hornet's nests back in the day when Gamergate was the thing to be talking about. But I still find that Feminist Frequency really put forward some very different perspectives that I definitely hadn't considered at the time, and has really opened my eyes to really paying more attention to how other people feel about game development and story structure in games and certain perspectives of who's developing those games and things. So if nothing else, I think it's a very, very at least interesting take on perspectives on games that, you know, the general gaming audience may not consider, i.e. just white dudes like us. So yeah, like I said, all of these will be linked in the show notes. So if any of them take your interest, be sure to follow them up.
And I just want to say though, if anyone else has something that is not covered in the show notes, if a listener has a channel that they know of that's not mentioned here, by all means, let us know.
Put
it, you know, jump in the Discord and share it out. Like, you know, as I said, I don't watch a lot of this stuff, but I am massive into learning about everything video games. So if there is something somebody's deep dived into, you know, the reason why we went CDs instead of cartridges, you know, something like that, you know, let us know. Share the knowledge that you have with us and the other listeners, because, you know, everyone loves to learn new things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, give me all your channel secrets.
Yeah, for sure. Luke, you haven't talked in a little while, like unlike we have. Why don't I throw the Fortnite forecast over to you?
Sure. Let me try an announcer voice. Mm-hmm. No, I won't do that. So the Fortnite, the forecast covering November 7th, which is today, the date of recording, and November 21st. We have on November 11, Grand Theft Auto, the Trilogy Definitive Edition, not to be confused with the PS2 release of the Trilogy. At this point, it is digital only. It will be retail on December 7th. We also have Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic as a digital release on the same day. The day after is when Shin Megami Tensei 5 releases. November 16, we have Grow, Song of the Evertree, which is made by the Yonder developers here in Australia. So it's an Australian-made game. And we also have Surviving the Aftermath, which is a turn-based, a top-down sort of survival game. And then, of course, if you're into this stuff, November 19, we have Pokemon Brilliant Diamond and Shining Pearl.
Yeah. Anything here that anyone's interested in picking up? I'm sure Ollie's all over Shin Megami Tensei 5.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be buying that day one. I was so keen to do the review, and then I was like, oh, it's so close to Pokemon. So unfortunately, I wasn't able to do that. But we will have a review out for that, hopefully before it comes out. You know, I think
I'm all over Star Wars.
Yeah,
I don't know if I'll pick it up, but I definitely want to see what it's going to be like on Switch. The Knights of the Old Republic.
Yeah. I suspect honestly, it's going to be very much like the iPad version.
I had it on iPad, and I got it on Steam many, many years ago, like over a decade ago. And then I got it for free on Games with Gold on Xbox, and then it somehow disappeared. So I have it in multiple different places, so I'm probably not going to get it on Switch.
I think, honestly, pretty much everything that was in our forecast is something that I'm going to pick up eventually. So
yeah, big Fortnite. Big Fortnite this
yeah,
coming huge. Couple of weeks. Let's quickly go through some games that we're playing. Again, Luke, you can start us off.
Sure. So I have put in a lot of time into a game called Weird West, It's not coming to Switch or anything at any time soon, but it's a PC title at the moment by a new studio called Wolf Eye Studios, and it is founded by the co-founders of Arkane. So when they left Arkane, this is the studio they started up. So if you like Dishonored, basically the core team that made that left Arkane, they've spun up this studio. And it's kind of Diablo meets a twin-stick shooter set in the Old West with werewolves and other sorts of mythological beasties. It is very cool. And because you can play in different ways, you can go in guns blazing or you can go stealth, how you play sort of impacts how everything happens around you. And the other small game that I've put a lot of time into over the past week and a bit is Forza Horizon 5, which I reviewed that for MaxiGeek. That's the both preview and review are on my site. And Forza Horizon 5 is more Forza. If you liked Horizon 3 or 4, you're going to like this one. So, yeah, that's what I've been playing.
Nice. I'm
so excited for that.
Yeah, same.
So excited. What's the next?
I'll go next. I've been playing through the Halo Master Chief Collection in split screen with my sister. I've been really enjoying it. I had never played Halo 2 before.
Oh, for goodness sakes.
I know. I played 1, 3, Reach, ODST 4, but never Halo 2. And I'd always heard that it was like the worst in the series. Absolutely is not. It's something that I see on like Reddit and Resetera all the time. People say, Halo 2 is the worst. Nah, it is incredible. Easily my favorite game in the series. Absolutely. It's so good.
It has a horrible ending.
Sure. It does have a horrible
gameplay is fantastic. And that's
because of the development cycle, which, by the way, I forgot to mention this. That the Legendary Edition or whatever it was, the Collector's Edition of Halo 2 came with a sweet documentary. It's super corny to watch now because the music choices are so 2004. But the documentary that went alongside of it even details the fact that they were so pressed for time and that they weren't entirely happy with the development process of the game, which is interesting to see come out with the game. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah.
But do you guys find it hard to play those games at the moment, though? Like, I only play... Okay, a huge confession. I would get judged so hard. I only played Halo 1 and 2, like, in the past 2 years. And I played it co-op with a friend. And I enjoyed playing them with my friends, but... The game mechanics are so incredibly dated.
Absolutely.
Like, yeah. I really struggled to play through
them. They're 20-year-old games. Also, what kind of sucks about the Master Chief Collection is that there are different control schemes for the different games. They never remade the game with a unified control scheme, which makes it so much harder to play. Like, the first couple of games, you got to punch someone, you have to press B, but then in later games, you have to press right bumper and all that kind of junk. Like, it's just, and same thing with like using vehicles and stuff, like to get in at different buttons. And it's just, it is a bit of a nightmare.
Yeah. But yeah, I've been enjoying that a lot. Just playing through co-op. I mean, I'm a little bit disappointed that they didn't do more, customizations in the Master Chief Collection for, the 360 games. So Halo 3 and ODST, because it's showing that the first two were remastered and improved, and then you go into Halo 3 and like you've got letterboxing on the side when you're in split screen because they're like, oh, it has to be 16:9, so we're just gonna, you know, squash the screen down.
To be fair, they never use of war as well.
Yeah.
It's the same deal.
But yeah, I mean I've enjoyed everything I've played so far, and I'm looking forward to playing the rest in split screen, but not Halo Infinite in split screen because that won't have it
at launch.
At launch, it'll probably come down the line. I've also been playing.
I just want to say though, with the Master Chief Collection, 1 and 2 were completely remade originally for the Xbox One, and the Halo 3 ODST that was actually just given as an apology when the Master Chief Collection launched initially. So they kind of just went, hey. It works. Here's the game. And they didn't touch it at all. They made it as an apology for people because of so many problems that the collection originally launched with.
Yeah. So. I've also been playing Animal Crossing New Horizons with the DLC. I've been playing Happy Home Paradise so much. I think it's basically all I've done since Friday. I enjoy making little houses for dumb little creatures. So, yeah, been putting a lot of time into that. And I've not had a
chance to jump back in yet, and I'm so scared.
You will lose many, many, many hours to it. But I've also been playing Mario Party Superstars online with Michael, which has been a lot of fun.
Super fun.
We've had a lot of great time. And if you're in the Discord, please let us know that you want to play Mario Party Online with us, because we're so desperate for other people in Australia.
Please, anyone, hello, help.
I mean, that's a good segue, just a little tangent there. In the Discord, there is a multiplayer channel. So even if you're not interested in Mario Party at all, if you're wanting to play any other Switch game online with people, jump in there, put the call out. Obviously, don't drop in and then expect people to be there 2 minutes later, because it may not happen. But if you're planning on a night of gaming and you want people to play with, jump in there and do it, because you know there are people always looking to play games in there, even Federation Force for some bizarre reason.
I think we have a dedicated channel for that still.
Yeah, we have a dedicated channel to Fed Force.
Michael, what about you?
Yeah, might as well, good segue, might as well. Yes, I've been playing Mario Party Superstars with Ollie online and some randoms as well, which is super, super fun. If anyone is looking for an incredible Mario Party game with some classic boards and a probably top-tier selection of mini-games from the series, like, it is really, really good, with some online functionality that actually works and works consistently, Mario Party Superstars is your game. I've been playing Overwatch, of course. I don't know why I keep adding this in. I really need to stop. It's just so stupid. But another game I've been playing with some friends, and I'm probably going to be playing after I record this podcast, is a game called Pulsar. It's sort of like a lo-fi Star Trek bridge simulator. So you're on a ship. Everyone has their role as a captain, as a science officer, weapons officer, engineer, all that type of jazz. And yeah, you fly around the galaxy and everyone does their role. You have to try and balance, you know, energy consumption and scanning and all that type of jazz. You can beam down onto planets and explore and do missions. It's super, super fun. Having a great time playing it with mates.
Nice. I've been playing some Monster Hunter Rise with my girlfriend in the evenings when we come back from work or rehearsals and things like that. So that's been good. Been ticking off all the monsters that were just absolutely munting off the land. Last night, I just discovered that your pieces of armor have specific like buffs to them. I had no idea that was a thing. And I'm wondering how many Monster Hunter games have had that and I've completely missed it. So I've just been going back and upgrading all of my armor that I have. And now I can actually beat monsters. I'm such an absolute knob when it comes to Monster Hunter, I swear.
Just want to point out.
Can you answer that question, Ollie? So
the
you can
armor buffs have been in the game since Monster Hunter Freedom Unite 2 on the PSP.
Oh, so there you go. So this is
quite some time.
The entire decade that I've been playing the series, I had no idea. To be fair, I hate when there are menus within menus in video games. I'm the guy that gets like one menu in, and if there's a tutorial for another menu, I just skip it. I was like, nah, I'm not worrying about crafting. I'm not worrying about alchemy. I just want to slash stuff. Anyway, and I've also been playing Mario Party Superstars, not with these guys though, because I didn't realize that they were playing because I have neglected the Discord lately and they chastised me, rightly so, for not having played with them.
Disgusting.
So we're going to fix that. Anywho, we're almost on time here, guys. Let's get into Nintendo 20 questions. So Luke, you're in charge here.
Yes, I am. This is not a user-submitted entry. This is a Luke pick. So you may begin your questioning.
Great. I'll start off with the way I always do. Was this game released after 2010?
After 2010? Yes, it was.
Was it released before? Nah, there's no point even asking that. I was going to say before 2020. What's the point? Do you... can you see your character in this game?
Yes, you can.
Okay.
Probably not a puzzle game.
Or even a racer? Would we say that if you're playing like a racing game like F-Zero, would we qualify that as seeing your character?
I would. I would say like,
okay,
if you're playing a racing game, the character is the vehicle, really.
Okay.
Was this released on a home console?
A home console? Yes, it was.
So it's still down to Wii, Wii U, and Switch.
Yeah.
Was this a cartridge-based game?
Sorry.
A cartridge-based game? Yes, it was.
So not Wii U or Wii. And not specifically a downloadable game either. Maybe.
I mean,
on Wii.
The answer is still correct either way.
Well, but like if it was 3DS, for example, it's not like a game that was only on the
show. No, but it's a home console, right?
Oh, right.
Yeah. So saying it's on cartridge, still, it could also be available to download. Like,
yeah, but what if it's one of those weird ones where it was like, you know, this N64 game only came out in 2020?
Yeah, I'm not pulling an Angelo on you, so don't worry about it.
What? Who are pulling an Angelo? You talking about Star Fox 2? Because okay. That was Darren. That was not me.
Oh, that's such an incredible pick. That's so good.
Anywho.
You've not touched on genre, yeah. You've not touched on developer.
Is this a shooty game?
Yeah.
A shooty game? No.
Okay. So that eliminates
like
all the 4,000
games on the Switch.
Yeah, but you,
yeah, there's just so many.
There's no shooting in this one, though.
So was this game published by Nintendo?
Published by Nintendo? It was not.
Was it developed in the US?
It was developed in the US.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so a cartridge-based game for a home console, no shooting, and you can see your character.
Hey, is this a 3D game? Does it have 3D polygonal graphics?
Yes, it is.
Okay. That knocks out a lot of indie games.
Okay. I could go with the combat thing again.
Mm-hmm.
Or
I was just thinking that.
Is there combat in this game?
Yes, there is.
Okay.
The combat, but no shooting.
No shooting. So it could be like a swordy game, like a Skyrim or something like that.
Like a fighter.
Or a fighter.
I really need to get the genre, I think.
Is this an adventure game?
An adventure game? Yes.
Okay.
That's 10.
Okay. So a hesitant adventure game. There's probably adventures in it.
3D adventure games that were developed in the US.
So there's still Skyrim.
I was thinking Skyrim.
Could be one of the Star Warses. No, some of those have shooting. Or all of them have shooting.
I guess Skyrim also has shooting. You can shoot a bow.
Yeah.
I will clarify at this point. You asked if it's a shooty game. And I said, no, it's not a shooty game. I didn't say there wasn't shooting. I just said it's not a shooty game.
Right. So it's not a shooter. Okay. But it could have shooting. Like, you know, you use a bow or a crossbow or whatever.
I just figured I would clarify that particular point.
That's fair.
You can see your character. I don't know. Is there a little crossover between platformers and adventure games? Like, if a game was obviously a platformer, would you call it an adventure game?
Metroids are adventure games, aren't they?
I would say that they are, yeah.
Yeah.
You got the Ori series as well.
Mm-hmm.
Technically 3D.
Technically 3D. It's pushing it a bit.
So, all right, is this...
I mean, it is. It's 3D elements. It's all painted.
Is this game a side-scroller?
Is it a side-scroller? It is not.
Okay, so sorry.
Cool. So I don't know, maybe I'm still sort of leaning towards Skyrim or that kind of a game. What else is there? Mm-hmm. That's 3D, you can see your character, is an adventure game that's not like Breath of the Wild or something.
Also, that's developed in the US.
And it's cartridge-based, so it got a physical release.
Don't forget, there is a ton of like indies that get... Like, yeah, you know, limited run games and stuff releases.
But what's an adventure game that's 3D that would qualify? That would have been big enough.
I mean, I know a few, but I can't tell you.
That would be big enough to get a physical release, though.
Thinking of New Super Lucky's Tale.
What kind of
an adventure platformer.
What kind of combat's in that? I've never played it.
Think you can
sort
just
of like a 3D platform stuff
and swipe your tail at stuff as well.
Okay.
This is a tough one.
So how many questions is that?
You're on 13.
Okay. Does this game have levels?
In what context?
As in, like, you load into a level. It's not just one complete open world.
Then yes.
Okay.
I wasn't sure if you meant that or, like, character levels.
No. So it's...
That's why I wanted clarification.
So it's not like a Skyrim. It's not an open world. It could be something like a ukulele.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. But Ukulele was developed in the UK.
That's true.
Playtonic is a UK developer.
Yep.
Maybe Oceanhorn? Maybe?
That's the other one I was trying to think of.
Yeah.
Or Oceanhorn 2.
Did that get a physical release?
Did Oceanhorn get a physical release?
I feel like it might have. like a limited one.
I feel like Oceanhorn 2 did.
How many questions is that, Luke?
You're on 14.
Okay, so we've got five more. So I feel like we're not too far off. We're sort of getting closer. We've got some boxes ticked. So I think we just need to tick a couple more. What could steer us on the right path? Art style?
I think it's specific. Oh, no. Yeah, I guess. Don't worry about it.
RPG elements?
You can ask developers or publishers because you haven't got any of that yet.
Yeah. I feel like we'd just be taking stabs in the dark at this point about those, though.
Unless it's a big one. That's the thing.
Or if it's in...
If it's like a big publisher.
Or if it's an indie, which we haven't specified.
I mean, like, it could be something like Diablo, for example. I would say that is adventure-y.
Yep.
For sure.
And would we say that combat. Would we say that you load into levels on that one? I guess you might.
There's five discrete stages. Acts. Like, they're not all interconnected.
Would this game be classified as an RPG?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. An action RPG.
So it's not like Lucky's Tale or anything like that. So presumably that means that there'd be some leveling up, maybe some class-based stuff. So it could be Diablo. Well,
yeah, or other different playable classes in this game.
Yes, there are.
Okay.
Should we ask if it's top-down? Could be like Torchlight or something.
Oh, that's a good point, actually.
Does this game play from a top-down perspective or an isometric perspective?
It does not.
Oh, dang. All right. Well, there's none of those.
Thinking probably not Oceanhorn either, because I think the first one is the only one that got a physical release on that.
That's also isometric.
Isometric, yeah.
Oceanhorn is a very, very clear Wind Waker style game.
Kingdoms of Amalur was on Switch.
But I gotta clarify, when Angelo said top down, like, are you classifying that as like literally like top down or like any overhead?
Any point where the camera is either directly above or to a 45 degree angle for isometric.
Yep.
Okay. Cool.
So did Kingdoms of Amalur came to Switch as well, didn't it?
Yes. So in the Re-Reckoning.
Yeah, so that version. Could be one as well. So there are a bunch of RPGs. We just got to nail down which ones. Could ask if it was a re-release.
Yeah.
Also, we already clarified home consoles. Like, could be 3DS, but no.
Yeah.
was Dark Souls developed in Japan, the port?
I believe the Dark Souls one was done by Virtuos, which is a Chinese company. Okay. If not them, then Iron Galaxy, which is, I believe, based in Singapore.
I'm sure Luke would go with the original developers, though. And it would be Japan. But is this game a re-release?
Is this game a re-release? Yes, it is.
Okay.
Right.
So we've got like two questions left, I think.
One and a guess,
yeah.
All right, so what's going to steer us on the right path here? We definitely know it's an RPG.
Same with Witcher. Was Witcher developed by CD Projekt Red, generally?
That was done by the button people. I can't remember what the name is.
The button people.
The button people.
I don't know. I can't remember what their name is.
You're thinking Panic Button, and it wasn't them.
Oh, really? Yeah. It must have been another Virtuos one, I think.
No, it wasn't them either.
Wow.
I've been asking a lot of questions. US developer. I've been asking a lot of someone else ask our last one, I guess. We could ask if we've mentioned it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the cheaty meta one, but have we mentioned this game?
Yes, you have.
Okay. So what are the ones that we've mentioned that qualify? The Witcher?
I think it's just The Witcher and Kingdoms.
Kingdoms?
I think that's it.
Torchlight, is that only isometric?
That is only isometric, yeah. I think it has to be Kingdoms. I can't think of anything else that we've mentioned that would be there, unless it's Oceanhorn 2 and that was somehow developed in the US and has a physical release, which I don't think it does. But
I've got a feeling it's Witcher.
Oh, it loads in. Loads into levels. Witcher doesn't do that. Witcher's open world.
Yeah, so it can't be Witcher.
Does Kingdoms load into levels?
I have no idea.
I feel like The Witcher.
How many questions do we have left?
Might. That's it. We haven't got any more. We've got the guess.
Yeah, oh, none. Guess. Oh, God. And we've mentioned it before.
I feel like, yeah, it shouldn't be The Witcher in that case. It could be Kingdoms. But Kingdoms is also open world.
Let me clarify this one point. You asked the question, does this game have levels?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I said, in what context? And you said that you load into other things.
Yeah.
And I said,
yeah, yes. But I'm not saying it has loading screens. I mean, like from a menu or something like that. Like Super Mario 64, for example, you have to load into, you have to actually go to a painting and jump into a level. Like that's what I mean by levels specifically. It's not like you go to like a dungeon and then you go to the other side of the world and then you go into a town. That's kind of what I meant.
When you said levels, I just took it to mean that you go into levels,
okay,
from sort of a hub world, a la Mario 64.
Oh, yeah, so that's what Jesus. I was asking. That's literally what I asked.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I said, yes, it does.
Yeah, okay. So this game does, yeah, okay. So you do have to go and load into a separate environment. It's not an interconnected world. So I haven't played Kingdoms of Amalur. I'm pretty sure that that's open world though, isn't it?
Yeah, genuinely, I have no idea. I've never played it. I just know that it exists and has different classes.
So in Skyrim, there's areas where you like load into a dungeon, right, from memory?
Yeah, but it's not really a hub world. Like the dungeons are just like a door off to the side.
Yeah.
Most of it takes place in the overworld.
Yeah.
I think our best guess is Kingdoms of Amalur.
And we've named the game. Just...
Yeah, that's the really frustrating part, is that like we know we've brought it up.
Okay. Yeah, just go for it, Ollie. Ask if it's that, I guess.
Yeah, sure.
All right. Is the game Kingdoms of Amalur Re-Reckoning?
All right. I'll give you these tips first. First is Witcher was ported by Saber Interactive, who also just recently did the Crisis ports.
Okay.
And World War Z.
They're American, right?
They're American. But they also have studios in Italy.
Okay.
CD Projekt Red were the ones that did that. They outsourced to them. For Kingdoms of Amalur Re-Reckoning, that was developed in the US by Big 43, but the Re-Reckoning release was done in Germany. So it is not Kingdoms of Amalur Re-Reckoning.
Hold on.
But we're asking if the game was developed, not like, which means like the initial release of the game.
You asked if this was a re-release.
Yes,
yeah, and we also the re-released was developed by a non-US. But
that's such rubbish.
But like, it doesn't matter because like we don't know who did it anyway. Like we could have, like I have no idea who made it. It could have been a Japanese studio
Re-Reckoning was all done in Europe anyway, but the game itself was the Elder Scrolls V Skyrim.
Okay, cool.
Wait, so what stopped us from going that route?
Because I didn't... I vetoed Michael's idea of the fact that dungeons are levels.
This is another classic moment of someone vetoing my idea.
What levels are we loading into in Skyrim? Where it's a completely separate
level. You're loading into any of the dungeons, caves, towns. There's alternate areas you load into with the expansions.
But that's...
It's one of those things there's no like clear answer to that question.
Absolutely. Skyrim is an open world game. You don't jump into a painting and then go to a desert.
But you do load into the dungeon. I don't know.
But the concept is the same, whether you're in the Mario Castle overworld and you go into the level through the painting, whereas you're in the Skyrim overworld and you go into the dungeon via the doors.
No one says that you go to the something level in Skyrim.
No, they say you go into the dungeon.
Yeah, exactly.
Which most people would.
Like, that's what I'm saying.
That's why I wanted to clarify that point with you earlier, though, is sort of what you were thinking of about levels.
Listeners, tell us if we got it right.
Yeah, totally.
Tell us who was in the wrong here. I mean, it's a loss either way. Like, we could have gotten there, but we didn't. But let us know what you think.
We definitely could have gone there.
I'm sorry.
I do want to point out, though, Ollie said Iron Galaxy, and Iron Galaxy did do the Switch port of this game, but they're based in Chicago, not in Japan.
Hold on, can we just also set a ground rule that when we say, is the game developed and it's a re-release, can we actually talk about the initial development of the game? Because I think it's absolute tripe that we say that the re-release was developed in a completely different country, because that doesn't count.
Unless it's like a remake. If it's a remake,
if it was it's completely remade, that's different. But if it's just a re-release, like, come on, man.
Well, Re-Reckoning was an enhanced re-release. I don't know what you would call that. It's not technically not a port because they did work on it.
But the game was made in remake. The game was made in America. It was made in the state of Long Island.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not disputing that fact.
Yeah, so that's what I mean. Like,
if all of the assets were remade and they were made by a European company, it's kind of like, you know, the Theseus' ship thing, right?
Yeah, but
like if you've replaced all of the assets, then like, is it still the same game?
But if a book was written in America and it was published in England, we're not going to say the papers were made in England, therefore it's not an American book. Like, it's...
No, but like if an English person rewrote every single page and then released the book, then it would be English, right?
No. Because the book was written in America by an American. Like,
a book's probably not the best analogy for that.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, context. The initial concept of the game itself was made in whatever. We'll yell about this outside of the podcast. That about wraps up this week's bookcast. Be sure to head to the site www.books.net for all your Nintendo news, reviews, and everything in between while Michael dies. To keep up to date, follow the site on Twitter @books.net, all spelled out, or jump on over to our Discord at bit.ly/booksdiscord, all lowercase, all one word. Ollie, where can people find you?
Oh, you can find me inside Discord or on Twitter @checkable, CHOCOBALT.
And what about you, Luke?
They can find me on floating around the Discord or anywhere online at RenderMed7 or also over at MaxiKeek.com.
And Michael?
You can also find me in the Discord and also on Twitter at SubElement, SubElement.
And you can find me in the Discord, quietly weeping in the corner, at Mangelo, and on Twitter, with the same name, but with a zero at the end. And over at Twitch, I'll be returning to doing some streaming over the next few months, thankfully, at Mangelo Show, with no zeros there. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next fortnight. Bye-bye.